Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Mr. Brent Johnson, it's a pleasure to see your face again for the fourth time this week. We are two busy finance bros, and here we are doing a full-length episode, even though our recent Madness edition post was quite long as well. So we're rolling into the start of the weekend. It's been a interesting week so far. There's a lot for us to talk about. One of the first things I wanted to bring up to kind of move us into the overall depth of conversation we're going to have here is, we, as I just mentioned, we just posted this Madness edition, which is, it's the second installment where you and I get to kind of return to some of what started this whole thing for us. Like, you know, us having fun conversations at the end of the week, sometimes over tequila, sometimes over a coffee. And we, you know, brought this Madness edition into the fold where we get to talk about some of the stuff that's going on in markets, the more personal side of things. We labeled it Madness Edition because we know some people are just so market obsessed that that's all they want. And, you know, recently on this most, the episode we just published, there was a comment saying, hey, you know, you guys have fun with your Madness thing, but I'm going to hang back and wait for your market stuff. But the human element to all of this is so important. And it's such a key driver of markets. And one of the things I've started to notice, not only like we highlighted in the world and in society, there's these tensions and conflicts that are going on. But for so long, as you've been talking about, there's tension and conflict between the doves and the hawks, the bulls and the bears. For the first time, it feels like this week, the sentiment is starting to shift, and people who've been carrying more of that bullish tone have started to show some signs of fatigue. Are you noticing some of the trend shift perhaps in where positioning is, or just, you know, the narrative?
Well, it's kind of amazing how quickly it's changed. And I shouldn't say it's amazing because this is how it always happens, right? You finally get that last person, you know, to jump in the pool, and then all hell breaks loose. And I don't think it would be fair to say all hell has broken loose yet. But, you know, I'll take it back. You know, at the very beginning of the year, just one very simple indicator is the put-call ratio. And at the very beginning of the year, the put-call ratio was the highest it had ever been. And, you know, we talked about how that could potentially lead to a short squeeze because positioning was offsides. And that's exactly what happened. And then, you know, as of a month ago, it was completely reversed and it was back to its all-time low because everybody was now in the market, right? And there was nobody willing to buy puts anymore. And sure enough, you know, about that time, within a week of that kind of high coming in on the put call ratio, or the low coming in, the market started to roll over. And, you know, since that time, I think the Dow is off 3% and the NASDAQ's maybe off 6%. So they've pulled back. They haven't crashed, but they've pulled back. And just in the last couple of days, that put call ratio has dramatically swung. And now I don't think it's back to its high, but it's getting back up there again. So it just kind of shows me that even the people that jumped in within the last month probably knew when they were jumping in they shouldn't do it, right? It's like, you just know. But the FOMO is just killing you, and you just can't help it, and you jump in. And then sure enough, everything rolls over. And I think a lot of them are very quickly, you know, repositioning either out or buying protection or whatever it is. So people who think that investing or trading is all about, you know, mechanics or understanding the fundamentals or learning how to read a chart or learning how to read a financial statement. I mean, it's much more important to understand psychology, and especially your own psychology, than it is to understand all that other stuff. That other stuff's important and you need to know how to do that. But the 6 inches between your ears is probably the most important thing to understand out of all of it.
Or that 6-inch organ in your chest that's sometimes driving the decision more than the one between your head. Yep.
And let's just leave it like right there with body parts. Let's not move anywhere else.
So, speaking of, no, I'm just kidding. So as we were talking about sentiment and the human aspect to some of this, you know, people are always searching for the narrative. And I feel like for the overall boom and bust cycle narratives, China always finds its way into both of those. And I think, you know, the last couple of times we've had big recessionary events, specifically the GFC, you know, the Chinese or China credit impulse was a big part of that recovery. You know, it's a new world, you know, the supply chain disruptions and people becoming more nationalistic, both politically and geopolitically, as well as just in terms of business operations. It seems like China is struggling to kind of, not only for themselves, but for the rest of the world, be that credit engine that keeps the market going at a time when things feel like they're slowing across the globe. Now, there's a couple of things that you mentioned just a moment ago that I want to highlight on before I pass the mic off to you. The put-call ratio is interesting. You mentioned that earlier in the year when it was lopsided one way and then it's kind of come back the other direction. We have put some emphasis on FOMO in a couple episodes. Now, a few weeks ago, we did have a conversation that we revisited a conversation we had in the beginning of the year for an episode called Japanese Jawbone Roulette. Just recently, we did one with the title Hell is Coming, and we talked about various aspects of these forthcoming downward pressures on markets, and we revisited that Japanese carry trade and the role that the yen plays. Do you want to kind of encapsulate in a similar way the role that China is playing? And I won't get into specifics yet until you kind of share your thoughts, yeah. But there are certain things that are starting to come apart in China at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And the first thing I'll say as we get in there is that, you know, a lot of times in order to keep, you know, this show kind of on a certain track and to have a certain flow to it, we'll come up with topics, right? And we'll talk about certain things. But it's important to remember that all of this stuff is connected. So you can't just focus on China. You can't just focus on the yen. You can't just focus on the put-call ratio. You can't just focus on psychology. And, you know, what happens in California affects what happens in Tokyo, and it affects what happens in Frankfurt. And so it's really, especially when you're talking about macro events, you know, it's hard to, you know, just isolate one piece of the pie. Now, if the whole world is trending up or trending down in one direction, then you can kind of focus in on one little industry or something. But I think right now, macro is more important than ever. And because macro is so intertwined with each other, even though you might be talking about the yen, the yuan in China is part of it, and the dollar is part of it, and the euro is part of it. So, you know, as we've talked about Japan a lot this year, it's been my view that the yen is kind of a key driver. Like, I think the yen and the dollar are the two most important things right now. But part of the reason I think the yen is so important is the influence it has on the yuan, right? And so, and the yuan is kind of loosely pegged to the dollar. Not exactly. It's very kind of a floating band, but, you know, in 2015, they did this kind of mini deval from the dollar. And then from there, they kind of pegged it to a basket and a kind of this loose basket. But since then, the yuan has been weakening. And part of the issue with the yen getting so weak is that it puts pressure on the yuan. And so then the yuan tries to weaken because they're regional competitors and they're both exporters. And so, you know, if Japanese goods are less expensive, then people buy more Japanese goods. Well, then that puts more pressure on China. And so that's why we've said the weakness of the yen has put pressure on China. And not only that, but China has to import a lot of their basic inputs for their economy. They have to import a lot of food. They have to import a lot of energy. They have to import water. So they, you know, they don't have a lot of the basic inputs that perhaps the United States has, right? And so because commodities trade in dollars, and I know that people will say, but they're starting to trade in yuan. Yeah, they are starting to be able to buy some commodities to a very small extent in yuan, but they still have to buy a lot of these in dollars. And so over the last year, as the dollar has gotten stronger and the yuan has gotten weaker, and we've had higher prices of commodities for a while because of the effects from COVID, then they were having higher costs to import these very important needed inputs, right? But at the same time, so they were having, you know, they were having inflationary pressures and needed inputs. But at the same time, they're having deflationary pressures from a deleveraging event in their real estate market. And so, you know, they're kind of, they've kind of got this damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they weaken the yuan in order to support the real estate market, it makes their input costs even more expensive. If they strengthen the yuan to make their import costs less expensive, then the real estate market comes under pressure. And not only that, but they had their real estate market has a lot of US dollar-based debt leverage in it. And so as the dollar has been stronger, that's put pressure on them. And so it's really kind of the worst of all worlds. Now, within all of this, and part of the reason overall markets have had a pretty good year so far, is part of this narrative that China was finally going to reopen. So, you know, a lot of the world reopened, let's call it 12 to 18 months ago, right? But China didn't. China kind of still had lockdowns. They, you know, they weren't allowing imports and exports to the same extent they were pre-COVID. But the whole idea going into the kind of the end of the year and the beginning of this year was China was going to reopen and they were going to do a credit stimulus. They were going to provide liquidity to the banks and to the industries. And then that was going to kickstart a growth trend. And so, you know, that has been a tailwind for the markets. But, you know, going into March, April, it hadn't really materialized too much. Well, so then, you know, people started to kind of question the narrative a little bit. So then the jawboning from the PBOC was, oh, no, we really are going to do it. We really are going to reopen. We really are going to stimulate. And so they've been stimulating. They've been easing the reserve requirements for banks. They've basically been doing the exact opposite of what the United States has. They've been doing easy monetary policy as compared to the tight monetary policy of the United States. And as a result, the yuan just keeps getting weaker and weaker. And so, and as the dollar gets stronger versus the yuan, and they've tried to do the stimulus, and the stimulus just hasn't worked, their real estate companies, a couple of them, Country Garden and Evergrande, have come under extreme pressure. And these are two of their biggest real estate developers. Evergrande just filed for bankruptcy protection in the United States for all their U.S. dollar-based debt. And Country Garden is, I think they're in the grace period on their debt payment. So they haven't technically missed it yet, and they haven't technically defaulted, but it's getting close to it. And so all of the, you know, and here's the thing is, if we do get a massive default situation in the Chinese real estate market, which is probably the biggest market in the world outside of foreign exchange, I don't know how many trillions it is, but it's tens of trillions, right? So if there ends up being a hole in that market and you get a credit contraction in that market, one of the ways that China would potentially counteract that would be to do an overnight or some kind of massive deval of the yuan, provide a, you know, massive bailout to that industry, and they would do that by, you know, quote unquote, printing yuan or devaluing the yuan, making it easier for those to pay off those debts. But that would massively depreciate the yuan. So, and what they would be doing by devaluing the yuan, it would be pulling inflation into China to counteract the deflation that's already in China. So think of it like that. They're pulling inflation. Well, if they're pulling in inflation, they're trying to export their deflation. Okay, so if they do that, if they devalue the yuan, that sends a deflationary wave to the rest of the world. And in that situation, the dollar rises dramatically. And we all know what happened last year, and we all know what happened in 2020, and we all know what happened in 2008 when you get a massive rise in the dollar. So this is why, you know, people talk about how the, you know, you can't taper a Ponzi. And they often say that with regard to the United States. But the reality is all countries are in the same system. And this is kind of one of my points is like, You can yell at the Fed and the United States dollar and the way that they have their monetary system all you want, but just recognize everybody else is doing the same thing. And so China is kind of in the place that everybody thinks that the United States is eventually going to get into and going to have to bail out all these industries, have to devalue the dollar. That's where China is right now today. Now, doesn't mean they're going to do it tomorrow, but that's the point, is that's what they're struggling with right now. And so if they do that, then they're going to be exporting that deflation, and that then sends the dollar higher. And then you get in these situations like, okay, so then that puts pressure on United States industries. And so then the United States industries, you know, they have to start selling assets. Okay, now that they start selling assets, you know, now you get markdowns on commercial real estate, right? So this is my point. Like, it's all related. You know, we can't just talk about the yen. You can't just talk about China. You can't just talk about the dollar, because it's all related. But the point is there is a massive hole in the Chinese real estate market. How they end up dealing with that, I don't know. But China's reopening and counteroffensive against their deflationary pressures is kind of like the Ukraine counteroffensive against Russia. You know, it got all these headlines, everybody's talking about it, but it hasn't really amounted to much. And now people, or even those in the West, are even starting to say, you know, this counteroffensive hasn't really worked. Well, people in the West are starting to say about the China reopening, you know what? This hasn't really worked despite their best efforts. And so what's the result? And I don't know what the result is, but it doesn't seem to be on a good path. And if you end up having a hole or some kind of a deleveraging event in the largest market in the world, that is a definite headwind. Whether it becomes a crisis, I don't know. I'm prepared for it, but it has the potential to be a massive crisis.
Well, before China ends up fighting any kind of war in Taiwan, they clearly have to tackle this war at home with the housing market, deflation, et cetera. You know, you mentioned Country Garden, Evergrande, the payment delinquency, we'll call it, issues that they're having. But there's actually been a little bit more, which kind of goes into this liquidity conversation as well. Liquidity, and you've mentioned it yourself, is really what drives markets. And it's probably one of the problems that China's trying to figure out, because to inject more liquidity, you want to devalue the currency, but then it has all these other knock-on effects that you just referenced. But two of their biggest shadow banking entities, or maybe a better way of describing that would be like a non-bank lender. It's well known that they're liquidity providers in the space, whether it's through leverage or collateralizing assets. I'm going to do my best Mandarin here. So one is Zhongzhou, and the other is Zhurong. So these are, the latter I just mentioned is referred to as China's Blackstone. And they have just recently skipped payments on a number of investment products. So now it starts to trickle into the average Joe's pocket. And this goes back to sentiment, which we talked about at the beginning of this episode. And this goes back to the things that we were discussing in the Madness Edition episode, where, you know, the average person's about to, you know, has been slowly taking it on the chin, and it's the 10th round and they're just tired of fighting the battle.
Yeah. And this is the issue. Like, now that these investment products are starting to be affected, that could lead to people selling these investment products. And think back to what happened in the US in March, right? When people started selling their investments or withdrawing their money from their banks, and then the banks had to liquidate securities that were under, they had holding these securities at mark to market or at mark to maturity. And then when they have to start marking them to market as they get liquidated, it caused a hole in the banking system. This exact same thing is in danger of happening in China. And they don't, if they have to start liquidating securities because people no longer want to stay invested in them, and the people start taking their money out of the banks, then that causes a liquidity crisis with China, right? Which is exacerbates what they're trying to avoid. And not only that, like I don't have the headline right in front of me, but over the last week, there was even some headlines where the PBOC was telling the banks that, you know, no sales of investment products, you know, basically locking down the accounts to where you couldn't get liquidity. And so, you know, that could go on for a while, but it can't go on forever. And long story short, there's just a lot of problems. We've talked about the problems in China for a long time. They seem to be coming to a head. I'm not sure how it's going to be resolved, but I don't think it's going to be resolved in a non-volatile way. Let me put it that way.
Well, speaking of liquidity, we, you know, how much of it is true? Another topic we talked about just a day ago or 2 days ago in the Madness edition. You can tell we're really pushing you towards that episode. It was fun and it was a little frightening, but there was a headline about student debt forgiveness again. How much of this actually happens? Who gets to participate? We'll all find out at some point, I suppose. But I bring that up partly because of liquidity, and partly because you were on a roll this week. Between things that you participated in, the number of times you and I had a chat and published a video, but you were super active on Twitter, and I think in your sweet spot, right in the zone, which is all about this the global monetary system, the dollar's role in that system, the role it plays for, you know, providing liquidity. And so you have this student loan forgiveness thing, which ultimately is deleveraging or debt destruction. And you have made the point over and over, especially this week, that any type of de-dollarization, the constant end of the dollar, fear-mongering and calling for, you know, something like a BRICS currency to replace it, that whole process is not something that, you know, you don't think can happen. In fact, you say it eventually it will. It's just don't think it's going to happen overnight and not without significant amounts of pain, because de-dollarizing is at the core deleveraging. And like you said, you can't taper a Ponzi and all of these systems are debt-based and you start destroying debt, the entire Jenga board starts to come down. So when you're looking at the student loan forgiveness thing, just as an example, is that at least maybe temporarily a bit of stealth liquidity, because now people don't have to worry about making those payments? Or at the end, when it's all washed out, is that just more deleveraging, sucking up more dollars from the system and making the system more fragile?
Well, this is where the devil's in the details kind of comes in, right? And I don't know. I'll admit I don't know all the details of the Biden plan and how they would potentially do this. And I'm not even sure that they know. And part of the reason I think that, you know, this is part of the reason why politicians are always a little bit cagey is some of them might be legal, some of them might be not. They might have to change a law in order to be able to do it the way they want to do it. It may, you know, they may float the idea and then they get so much political pushback, they change the way it's done. So it kind of depends on the way they would potentially do it. So on the one hand, there would be extra liquidity because if I'm a, you know, somebody who's been out of school for 10 years, and I still have student loans to pay, and instead of paying $1,000 on my student loan, I don't have to pay that anymore. Well, that gives me $1,000 to go on a trip or, you know, paint my house or buy a refrigerator or whatever it is. So that's stimulus, right? But if the way that is paid for is that the Biden administration and the Congress says to the banks, well, you were stupid, you loaned them the money, and, you know, you shouldn't have. And now that's a defaulted loan for you. And so in that case, money is destroyed because now the bank balance sheet gets impaired, right? And so now the bank has the less ability to extend new credit. And if you can't extend new credit, then the banking system starts to have a credit contraction. And the credit contraction means there's less dollars, not more. But if, on the other hand, the government says, well, you know, of course you didn't know that we were going to change the law and say that they didn't have to pay off their student loans, so in exchange, we will give you the money and we will pay for the bailout. So in that case, it's net liquidity, right? Now, where does the government get the money to do that? Well, you know, are they borrowing it, or are they doing QE to then give it to the Treasury? And so it kind of depends on how the details are. But in general, if it's a bailout, then it's net liquidity. But if it's a default, then it's negative liquidity. So, but that's an issue, right? And then that's one of the headwinds that we've talked about, is that this student debt deferment is scheduled to roll off, like, I think in the next couple of weeks, sometime in the next month. And so if that debt deferment rolls off and these loans are not forgiven, rather than being stimulus, now that's a headwind, because now people have to start making those payments again. You know, for 2 or 3 years, they haven't had to make those payments. If they have to start making those payments again, now instead of putting gas in their car or buying the refrigerator or taking that trip, now they've got to start paying their student loans again. So it would just be one more headwind that the economy runs up against.
Well, speaking of headwinds, in the last part of our conversation here, your friend Alex Jurevich, he shared one of his investor letters recently. And in this letter, he talks about his thoughts on what actually caused the 9% inflation that we saw this time last year. He talks, probably more importantly, or the emphasis or point he was making is the reduction in inflation that we've had and now being more in this 4% range actually has nothing to do with what the Fed's response has been since last year, which is the increase in interest rates and the tighter monetary policy. And so we talked about sentiment. We talked about things that, you know, maybe looked like tailwinds at one point starting to turn into headwinds and investor attitude towards risk starting to wane. Now you have an interesting perspective shared from someone like Alex putting into context the fact that inflation's kind of rolled over on its own is really the point here. And now the Fed has raised almost 600 basis points. You know, every time we talk about Fed rate hikes and, hey, maybe things aren't quite as bad as they seem. And we're just trying to, you know, give both sides of the story and somewhat, hey, Powell never thought he could go this far. We'll oftentimes get comments that say, you know, look at the lag. You're ignoring the lag. And it's no, we're not ignoring the lag. We know there's historically one that exists. So now we're giving the lag boys a little bit of credit here, which is, you know, the interest rate hikes and the tighter monetary policy from the Fed has nothing to do or hasn't really made an impact on markets yet. So I'm going to bring that up as a point. Also going to mention the Fed GDP now, which is kind of like their GDP forecast, is forecasting almost 6% GDP. So we know the Fed has such a wonderfully functional crystal ball. So I think that's kind of funny. And with those two things mentioned, I would love it too if you can wrap all of this up, because we talked about Japan many times before, and we use that to pivot into what's going on in China and how this is such an interesting macro world right now. You have been a little bit lately referencing some of the stuff that went on in October last year, you know, where the dollar was the strongest and you had all these things starting to break. The gilt market was under pressure. So this kind of all, basically what I'm handing off to you here is some specific data points to reference, but, you know, kind of teeing you up for a milkshake highlight, so to speak.
Yeah, so the first thing I will say is, if you don't know who Alex Gurev is, if you like what we're talking about, if you like this topic, if you like macro and you like thinking about these big issues and you don't know who Alex Gurev is, then you should find out who Alex Gurev is. You should follow him on Twitter and read everything he writes. So I'm lucky enough that I, and he's written a couple of books. You should absolutely get the books and read his books. He's literally in the top five smartest people I've ever met. He's brilliant. So just start off with that. So, and even if you don't agree with him, his thought process is excellent. So I would encourage you to kind of read his stuff, even if you have a different opinion. And the second thing I would say is that Alex started talking about this 18 months ago. And he, on the one hand, he was dead right, but the result just hasn't happened yet. And I'll tell you what I mean. So in April of 2022, yeah, right. So 18 months ago, or 15 months ago, 16 months ago, we were at a conference together in California. We were at a Real Vision conference, and we were sitting on a panel. And, you know, this is when inflation CPI prints were just really starting to accelerate, right? And the year-over-year numbers were starting to be like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9% year-over-year. And everybody was talking about how, you know, the inflation was transitory. People were so stupid. And, you know, they were clearly wrong. They didn't know what they were talking about. And this was the absolute... you know, this was the zeitgeist, right? This is what everybody was talking about. The transition, the inflation is transitory. You know, Yellen was stupid and Powell was stupid. And everybody at the conference was saying the same thing. And Alex gets up on stage and he says, "My biggest concern is massive deflation." And everybody's like, "What? Huh?" Right? They're like, and I knew exactly where he was going with this, because, again, once you kind of understand how the monetary system is designed, you understand that they typically go up, but you also understand that based on certain things, they can immediately crash. And that's what Alex was starting to talk about. And he was talking about, and I will say, I have not read this letter that you're referencing. I plan to read it, but I'm familiar with his views. And so I'm going to base what I say based on his views as I understand it. So, but you know, everybody should read the letter for themselves. The point was, is that a lot of the inflationary pressures that we saw coming out of COVID, it's not that the Fed, cutting rates didn't influence it, because clearly if they hadn't bailed out the markets, we would have had deflation, right? But the big part of it is that, you know, a lot of it had to do with just massive supply chain disruption. And if you have massive supply chain disruption and you cannot get supply of something, but you still have money to buy it, then the price goes up, right? And so that's what a lot of the inflationary pressures are from. And his point was, okay, so now those are going to start to loosen. The supply chains are going to, the mechs are going to start to work themselves out. And meanwhile, we have the Fed, you know, in the middle of the fastest rate hiking cycle in history. And so I think his point then and his point now is the Fed, and this is, again, this all this stuff is related. You know, a lot of people say the Fed is not political. Complete bull. I'm sorry. There's no other way to say it. Is there was so much pressure on them to fight inflation, they could not do anything. If Powell had said, you know what, we think the inflationary pressures are largely a result of the supply chain issues related to COVID, and therefore we are not going to raise rates and we're just going to let the market work its way out, he would have been yanked out of his chair within a month by Biden and Congress and whoever it was, right? So the politicians do have an ability to, they can't control monetary policy, but they can influence it. But anyway, so as a result, Powell, you know, Alex's point was that Powell is going to try to fight this inflation, even though he doesn't have to fight it, because the market is already starting to roll over on an inflation basis. And within 2 or 3 months from him saying that, it did. So it peaked, you know, it then peaked in June and July. And the inflation prints since then have gotten lower and lower and lower and lower. Now, they haven't crashed, and we still have the high levels of readings. But part of the reason that the CPI readings have stayed high is because of housing and owner equivalent rents, which makes up 25% of the CPI calculation. If you look at other things, you know, food prices have come down, you know, gas prices stabilized, and, you know, they went down, they've come back up a little bit. Oil was lower. So to Alex's point is inflationary pressures did start to come down. And if you just look at the market-based data, the Fed did not need to keep hiking at that same level, and they certainly don't need to be hiking now. And I think, if I'm guessing this is what the letter says, is that he thinks that, as we've talked about, there is going to come a point where these rate hikes, and that's the other thing, we've talked about the lag of the rate hikes. And so his point is that, you know, interest rates have been hiked 500%. In then 12 months. And now that things are starting to get refinanced, you know, they didn't get refinanced last year, or maybe they didn't get refinanced in September or December. But now, as things are starting to get refinanced at, you know, 500% higher rates than they were, you know, 18 months ago, that's going to be a big liquidity squeeze, because now everybody's capital is going to have to go to pay interest on the debt as opposed to whatever else they were doing previously. And then that is going to cause, we've talked about running into the wall, right? We've talked about how high interest rates are stimulative until you have to refinance and you hit the wall, right? And so if we hit that wall and interest rates are that much higher, it has the potential to not just cause a slowdown, but to cause a liquidity evaporation. And yeah, we started to see that with the banks in March. And so That's why he is saying that, you know, the hikes that Powell has done over the last year are orders of magnitude tighter than the markets would have deemed necessary. And so that's how you get a big liquidity squeeze in a crisis. And it's kind of related to the same thing that's happening in China, right? China's hitting that point now, and Alex is saying that we are going to hit it as well.
Yeah, and you again, busy week for you. You had a conversation with the gentleman over at Simplify. I really enjoyed that one. I mean, having you and Mike Green banter back and forth is always a fun thing to be present for. Now, one of the points that Mike is very, very deep in the devil of the details, right? He can split a chart like it's a piece of hair, right? So he's,
yeah.
One of the points he's talking about to kind of reinforce everything you just said has to do with volumes. The volumes are so poor right now, and specifically housing. I mean, it's an easier one, I think, for people to conceptualize because everyone can see that houses aren't selling, people aren't moving. Interest rates hit a 21-year high. They're sticky around 7% the last week and a half. And at some point, when you look at the low transaction volume, because right now there aren't any kind of there isn't a huge flow of sellers looking to exit. So therefore, the pricing pressure gets to exist on the upper band. But as soon as that reverses, you don't have the buyer support there. So as soon as you have an uptick in sellers, those prices can decline very, very rapidly. So in an illiquid market where there isn't a lot of volume, and this goes across the equity markets as well, it's kind of that smoke before the fire, because as soon as sentiment, again, a big point of this conversation, what we highlighted early on, as soon as that sentiment shifts, there's nothing there to catch that falling knife, and you hit these air pockets. Is that also something when you're referencing the last 12 months and you look at what was happening in October, some of these liquidity issues, do you see that creating a rising dollar effect considering what's going on in global markets?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing is, again, I wish I knew how to time this perfectly. You know, I just don't. But what I do know is high rates are stimulative until you hit the wall. And so I think you can participate in markets, but you always have to have a plan, to on how you're going to protect on the downside. And so the reason this is so important is for the exact reasons that's now showing up in China, for the exact reasons that Alex is talking about and the exact reasons that Mike is talking about. And the example we can use, again, is what happened with the banks in March. Once somebody had to sell because clients wanted their cash back, they couldn't mark to maturity anymore. They had to mark it to the last sale price. And then that creates a very kind of it can create a cascade where everybody else has to do the same thing. And so I think that's what Alex is talking about. That's what Mike is talking about. And, so I have a friend who owns a bunch of apartments in New York City. I was talking to him this morning. Another very smart guy. and he was telling me, he's like, listen, he says, I own enough apartments that I have to do a new lease every month. I go through lease negotiations at least once a month. He says, I can tell you, I have not had anybody trying to negotiate lower, and I have plenty of people applying to come in at a higher price. And he says, rents aren't falling. And I tend to, and his point's a good one. Like, there's no decreasing pressure on the rents. But if we hit the wall and people start to get laid off and those new people wanting to come in and pay the higher rate dry up, and then one person misses a rent payment and then somebody gets priced lower, it's just like we were talking last week with the commercial real estate in San Francisco. Nobody wants to sell. They put it off. Then finally somebody sells, 60% off, right? Now that affects everybody else. And so it's kind of the same thing. And the reason this is important is because rents or owner-occupied rent, however, is a 25% piece of the CPI. So until that comes down, CPI, even if gas, even if oil were to fall 20%, if owner-occupied rent doesn't, then CPI is probably not going to fall significantly. On the flip side, if owner-occupied rent fell 30%, which it could if we hit the wall, and gas prices go up 25%, it ain't going to matter because CPI is still going to be coming down because the owner-occupied rent will dominate the 3 or 4 or 5%, or maybe is energy 5 or 6%? I can't remember, but it's much higher. It's like four times as high as energy. So, you know, energy would have to have a four times as big a percent move to offset, you know, the owner equivalent rent coming down. And so this is, I think this is Mike's point, and this is Alex's point, is that they believe that the market is underneath things, that the market is slowing down, and that while they understand that nobody has had to sell yet, when they do have to sell, it can create a cascade very quickly, and liquidity can go from plentiful to not just less, but like gone. And that is the nature of our system. That is the nature of a fractional reserved debt-based monetary system. When people start to pull capital, money literally disappears because money isn't real. It's like all ephemeral, right? It's all like digital. It's just, it's the, you know, and it's just gone. It's just gone. And so that's why you can be humming along and everything's going fine. And then literally you get hit up, you know, you're getting hit inside the head with a 2x4 and, you know, you're 25% lower than you were the day before.
I think we got an awesome soundbite there that we can, it's just gone. It's just gone.
did you see the second Wall Street movie, Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps?
Yeah, I can't quite remember.
So there's this old guy and he does that. He goes, I can't do the same whistle, but that's what I had going in my mind.
I'm disappointed as a country boy. You don't have a variety of whistles. But, you know, it's interesting referencing the wall, because back to the letter from Gervich, you have, you know, investors on a path, the economy on a path. And in our, you know, sight view on the horizon, we don't see a wall. And to his point, this 6% or 5.5% increase in Fed funds rate is more or less the Fed all of a sudden erecting a wall quickly, right when the economy is not expecting it. So things are already kind of getting exhausted and slowing down. And then boom, all of a sudden the rate hikes finally take hold, and it's like an anchor around your weight. So that's one of the things that we're trying to highlight here is it's all fun and games until it's not. And then it's gone. And
and it really is a wall too, because if you think about it, if let's just use 1%. If a year ago rates were 1% and you didn't have to refinance, and then this year you had to refinance and rates were 2%. That's still 100%. That's double, you know, the interest cost is now double. It's, you know, it's significant, but it's not the end of the world. But if they were 1% and now they're 5% or 6%, and now your interest payment is 4 or 5 times what it was a year ago, that's a wall, right? And that's not just a little speed bump. That's a wall. That's like your car is literally running into the wall, and bad things happen when cars hit walls. So,
we have over the last couple conversations just brought to attention these factors, right? And we're not making predictions that the end of the world is here tomorrow. I think, these narratives are an important way to start to build a comprehension about all the factors that are in play, but it does feel like even just this week, sentiment has shifted a bit. China is having some real issues. That deflation gets exported into the world. Our banking system is kind of on its own bailout, if you will, and stealth QE [S2] Yep. [S1] With the Bank Term Funding Program. So it feels like, you've said too recently that bad things tend to happen in the fall. So we're not making any predictions here, but we're definitely enthusiastically watching, these slowly changing events. And one last point I'd like to add is that these data sets, whether you love them or not, doesn't change the fact that they're relevant, that the market is making measurements around them. They're making, playing expectations around them. So we get that the CPI is a crappy measurement of inflation. We get that your food is still expensive and things are out of control. That's not the point here. We don't love the data sets either. It's just in terms of the measurement that everyone is using, those measuring sticks are changing real time right now, and they could change much faster than they have been, particularly in the real estate portion of the CPI, as you discussed. So I think this is a good point to wrap it up, Brent. There was a lot happening this week, so I'm glad that we took the time and ran a little long on this episode to discuss them all. For anyone who's new to us, we are doing multiple videos a week But each one of those videos has an objective. We do a Monday peak of the week. We do a midweek update. I referenced a couple times the Madness edition that we do at the end of the week. And then we have our full length episode, which we're recording right now. And some point during the week, usually on a Tuesday, I will share a clip from one of those episodes. So depending on what you're looking for, the type of conversation, how much and how frequently you want to keep up with us, those videos are structured in a way so that you can kind of work through them like any kind of series that you would watch. You're not just jumping in with us randomly and trying to keep up with the rhetoric. There's an objective in each one of those episodes. So I'll leave it at that. You can find my friend here, Brent Johnson, on Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can find me at John Katsmita. Visit our website at milkshakespod.com. There's more information there and lots of fun stuff, including all those playlists and different types of videos I just described on our YouTube channel at milkshakespod. Brent, I think that'll do it for us. Any last words?
No, the only thing I would say is I should have said this earlier, is that I do think that the interview I did with Simplify was one of the better ones, because I think it kind of honed in on the message that that I've tried to get across to people. So for anybody that was interested in this conversation and wants to dig into that a little bit deeper, you know, I know John had tweeted that out as well. So go find that. And it was a pretty good interview.
And I appreciate you bringing that up, because our shows have timestamp chapters in them. And I know a lot of people just click the video, get started, and just kind of go through as it goes. But sometimes it's worth, you know, taking a look at the additional details, the description underneath the video, because there are things like various external links and points of reference that we make that I do put in there. And so I'll add a link to that video so everyone can jump to it easily. All right. Well, I appreciate you adding that a little extra resource, Brent, and I appreciate everyone for joining us. That'll do it. And we'll see you guys in a couple days. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.